till I don't try.
Testing. Testing. Okay.
I don't try.
It apparently looks like
I don't have much battery left, which I love.
I don't wanna try to anymore.
Okay.
I don't try to anymore.
Big always starts every episode with, "Hey everybody." But me, I don't think there's anybody listening. So I'm going to say, hey, me, who has to edit this thing. This is Rish Outfield, and this is another Rish Outcast. Let's see. I'm driving, as I always am when I do these. Otherwise, it would be a podcast that dares not speak its name. I really need to work on the feed and the website for the Rish Outcast. Just the other day, I looked, and because I created it when it was at Big's house, there's no way for me to edit the first episode. I don't have access to it. But everything past the first episode should be mine, and I should be able to fix things, make it better. I uploaded a bunch of little summaries for each episode so that when I finally get the darn things edited and uploaded, they'll be there. And I really do appreciate the two or three of you people who have mentioned that you listened to it and that you'd like there to be more. Thank you. Somebody the other day said that he liked my stories and that he would really like to hear more of them. And that, you know, that's nice. I appreciate that. I don't know that I've ever done an episode where I said, "Ooh, I like this story." You know, wait. What is it? There was one. The one where Batman saves the guy. That one I said, I like that story. It's not a great story, that I recognize. But I still like it. And I think it's possible to like something without saying that it's great or without being arrogant. Anyway, this is a story I wrote just last year. I was at the cabin I think it was the last time I was at the cabin. And I had started writing it the day before, the week before, or something like that, and then abandoned it because I felt like, oh, it's a weak idea for a story or something like that. I don't know. You guys can be the judge. But the next time I went to the cabin, when there's no television and no internet around, I accomplish a great deal. And I just sat and I wrote this thing, and I said, you know what? I'm not going to go to sleep until this thing is done. And so in pretty much one sitting, I wrote this thing. And now you're hearing it. And it is called Mick Goes to an Elementary School Carnival. And, you know, Big will often talk about his struggles with naming his stories. You know, sometimes he's not pleased with the titles that he comes up with. I think I know how he feels. This is not a good title, but I don't care. That's what the story is about. And I think it fits the story in a way. You know, if you're listening to this and you say, oh, hey, there's a much better title in this, why don't you just call it this? I'm not attached to the title. I could be happy to change it, especially if I realize that your title is better. But listen to the story, and then we can talk about it afterward.
You be the judge.
Mick Attends an Elementary School Carnival by Rish Outfield. Mick didn't have any reason to go to the kids' carnival. He had no children. It was his niece and nephew who went to Eastridge Elementary, and he was in a poor mood. He'd lost his job that Monday, having been late two or three times too many. The last time wasn't even his fault. He'd just stayed up late the previous evening and slept through his alarm. He'd gotten drunk last night and called his ex-girlfriend Anna, who was now seeing someone new. He couldn't really remember the conversation, except that he had told her he never stopped loving her and may even have cried. He hoped not, but he vaguely recalled her saying she didn't want to hear from him again and would not pick up if he called in the future. Maybe she had said that. He didn't quite know, but it had definitely gone badly. Today he planned on watching TV until he fell asleep, sitting in the apartment in his running shorts he never ran in anymore. But Dave, his little brother, had called to remind him about the school carnival and that he and Sherry were coming by at 5:30 to pick him up.
"Don't think I want to go," Mick said.
"Too bad, so sad," Dave said, ignoring him. "The kids expect you to come. Brian wants you to take him to the skee-ball square."
"They have skee-ball there?"
Mick asked, slightly intrigued. He and his brother had been something of skee-ball legends back in their day. "Sure, it's a fundraiser for the school. It'll be fun."
"Not sure of that,"
Mick muttered. "Then you'll have to pretend," Dave said. "And don't tell me you've got something better to do. I know you too well." Mick couldn't argue with that, and didn't feel much like arguing anyhow. Before long, Dave arrived, his wife Sherry in tow, and they insisted Mick accompany them. Sherry did express disgust at the condition of Mick's apartment, and the aged son's jersey he had thrown on to answer the door. Sherry wasn't Mick's biggest fan, but few really were nowadays. "Kids are in the car. Put on some shoes," Dave said. And that was that. The carnival was held in the gymnasium, lawn, and parking lot of the school, with big inflatable bouncy houses, a dunk tank, and relay races on the grass. Inside were games and booths, food and candy, and many, many children. A few kids cried, but for the most part, there was joy in every direction. Mick's niece had things she wanted to do, and people she wanted to greet, and finally the parents decided to split up. Sherry took her daughter off to get her face and nails painted, while the boys were left to their own devices. There was mini-golf, enclosed trampolines, dart-throwing, ring-toss, dunk-a-sixth-grader, beanbag tic-tac-toe, sack races, photo-ops with the school mascot, tug-of-war, even a limbo contest. The boy, Brian, had a big chain of tickets, and seemed eager to only go to the attractions where there was a big line. Mick did get a chance to strut his stuff at the skee-ball section, but it was more of a homemade plywood bowling track than actual skee-ball, and he did very badly, rolling the ball too hard every time. All around him were families. Kids were laughing, begging for cash, eating junk food, whooping with joy and shouting to their friends. Brian had so many little buddies he had to wave to or run over and greet that Mick was starting to realize how few friends he truly had. And the worst was seeing all the husbands and wives, fathers and sons, step-siblings and in-laws crowding around their children, holding hands, laughing and pointing at things only they found amusing, taking pictures, having a good time. Not that Mick wasn't having a good time, but he felt lonely and extraordinarily jealous of his brother. A couple, several even, of the women at the carnival were attractive, but the only single ones were teenagers, and Mick looked at them only furtively. He missed Anna. He knew it had been his fault they broke up in the first place, but he'd tried to fix that, tried to regain that good thing he'd had once upon a time. Despite his best efforts, he had failed. So much happiness around him just served to remind him that he no longer had it. "Cheer up, big brother," Dave said next to him, then lowered his voice. "A guy just told me about a booth we've got to visit next." They let the boys stand in line for a cakewalk happening in 6 or 7 minutes and headed back to the auditorium section of the gymnasium. Here, there were 4 or 5 little booths set up, all with curtained-off displays, like voting booths. The one ahead of them had a sign which read, "Scariest Minute of Your Life, $5. There were 3 or 4 families in that queue, mostly older kids, boys, a skeptical-looking mother. The curtain opened and a tween came running out, tears running down his face, crying hysterically. He kept on running. He was followed by a middle-aged fat man with a mustache who was holding his hands up by his head. They were shaking. "Hey, John," Dave called to him. "It can't have been that bad."
"It was awful. I..."
the fat man began, then froze in his tracks.
"I think I browned my pants."
His face turned red as he realized that, yes, his suspicions were correct. He made his way awkwardly for the exit.
"You know that guy?" Mick asked.
"He was Brian's t-ball coach." Mick looked back at the booth entrance and snorted. Even if it was a joke, he didn't feel the need to go in there. Facing tomorrow was scary enough. Dave pointed ahead of them. That must be the one. There was a gargantuan line for the next booth. More than 24 men, teenagers, and boys stood in it, anxious to step inside. There was another small voting booth beyond, and a sour-faced librarian type taking money in front of it. They had to crane their necks to see the sign. Sex with a supermodel. $10, it said. Mick laughed out loud. He had to look again to make sure he had read it right. No, right? His brother exclaimed, grinning.
At a grade school carnival.
Dave shrugged. A fundraiser's a fundraiser. A teenage boy staggered out of the booth. He looked like he'd been hit over the head with a frying pan in a cartoon. Should we ask him? Dave asked.
Wait, there's not really a supermodel in there, right?
First of all, how could there be? Second, how much sex could happen in a space made for one person? Third, again, how could there really even be a prostitute flagrantly selling her wares in there, let alone a supermodel? It's not real, is it? Dave asked the teenager. His eyes moved from the middle distance to the man standing before him. What? The booth, Dave said and repeated his question. It felt real, the boy said, and started to giggle. Dave laughed too and planted himself at the back of the line. Mick started to follow, but stopped and watched the guy in the front of the queue pay his money and go into the booth. He was tall and thin, about 40, and looked like a self-help guru or pastor, except for the cotton candy he held in his hand. The stranger was only in the booth for a minute, if that, and then came out, swaying like a drunken man, a smirk on his face. He self-consciously held the cotton candy over his crotch. Mick walked to the back of the line beside his brother.
What about Sherry? He asked.
What about her? She'll think it's funny.
That didn't sound like Sherry. That you paid $10 to sleep with another woman?
Dave slapped his back, amused at his brother's gullibility. Mick, it's a joke. Some kind of trick like the fortune teller lady. His daughter had had her palm read when they first arrived, and was told she would have 2 children, own a house with 3 stories, would live a long life, and would date a man who would someday become president. For some reason, this had delighted the girl.
I know, but she doesn't seem to have a sense of humor when it comes to this sort of thing.
Or anything else, he neglected to add. I'll tell her you made me do it, Dave said. And that struck him as a lot more believable. Ahead of them in the queue, people began to groan and make disappointed sounds. Mick stepped out of line to see what was happening. The librarian type had changed the price of the booth from $10 to $20.
Can they do that?
The somewhat simian-looking grandfather in front of them asked.
Well, it's all to raise money for the school, so they probably can do what they want, Dave said.
Only one person got out of the line. Mick watched him go, a black man with a 12- or 13-year-old son.
Next time, he was telling him.
Mick had to reconsider as well. He thought he might have $20 in his wallet, but he would need it to buy gas. When he checked, he only had 11.
Can you lend me some? He asked Dave.
I bought you $10 in tickets, he said, not enormously sympathetically. There's an ATM right by the soda machines.
Mick walked in that direction, then heard cheering over by the cakewalk. Brian had won a 6-pack of cupcakes, but some of the other children had won huge, delicious-looking pastries, pies, and a birthday cake with the school mascot drawn on it in blue frosting.
Did you see that?
The boy asked proudly, holding his plastic container aloft.
Where's my dad?
He had to go to the bathroom, Mick told him.
The boy thought that was a brilliant idea and led his uncle out into the hall to where the boys' restrooms were. Mick waited outside, holding the cupcakes, while the boy went in to do his business. His melancholy was creeping back in, only fading briefly when he saw the fat man who'd soiled himself come out of the bathroom, still shuffling unnaturally. Mick got his cell phone out, checking for missed calls. He had none, nor any text messages. He saw that his second-to-last call was to Anna Dite, and sighed. If only he remembered exactly what he had said, and how badly he'd botched things the night before. He was tempted to call her and apologize, but didn't have the courage. In the end,
he sent her a text.
Very sorry. I forgot how dumb I can be. You deserve better.
He hesitated before sending it, trying to foresee how she might take it, then went ahead and did so. It probably wouldn't fix things, but he didn't think it could make things worse. The guy dressed as the school mascot, a honey badger, whatever the hell that was, came over and stepped inside the bathroom to splash some water on his face. Mick chatted with him for a minute, discovering that he was an art teacher, only 26 years old, and regretted volunteering to wear the costume.
"Well, cash is cash, though, right?" Mick said, and was horrified to discover the man was doing it for free.
Mick's nephew came out of the bathroom, finally, and revealed he'd been waiting for his dad to come out of a stall in the boys' room.
"Oh, he's already out," Mick said, and offered to take the child to see him.
Back in the gymnasium, the virtual sex line, or whatever they were really in for, was now getting short. Dave was next in line, fishing money out of his back pocket. The price had been raised to $30 for sex, or sex, with a supermodel. There was a Wheel of Fortune off to their left, and Mick gave his nephew the rest of his tickets to give it a spin. He looked back at the ATM and saw a dubiously long line there as well. Instead, he approached his brother, planning to ask him when he got out of the booth whether it was worth going for. On the other side of that booth was another one, though, one with absolutely no line in front of it. "Change your life," the sign read. $5. The woman sitting at that table looked like his own kindergarten teacher. Like everybody's kindergarten teacher.
"Does it work?" he asked her.
"As well as the other two," she said,
looking at the men in the sex line with disdain. Mick was intrigued to see a couple of women in the supermodel line. He wondered if they expected Channing Tatum in there, or whoever his brother was now groping.
"Hey," the woman beside him said, drawing his attention. "It's for a good cause, even if it doesn't work."
He nodded and gave her his $10 bill. She gave him change, just as Mick heard his name called on his right. Dave came strutting out of the booth, his face red and a bit of sweat on his upper lip.
"Dude!" he shouted, a little too loudly. "What? What was it?" Mick wanted to know.
It wasn't a trick exactly, but..." Dave snorted, as if that said it all.
"But a supermodel..."
"It totally was! The one I like, from the Carl's Jr. commercial."
"Who? Kate Upton?"
Mick said, remembering how many times his brother had brought up that ad where the blonde beauty disgustingly eats a cheeseburger in a bikini top. "Yes!" Dave replied, floored that he had forgotten her name.
"You had sex with Kate Upton?"
"Yes." For a moment, Dave's face filled with so much pride, it looked like he really had. "Well, sort of."
"No, you didn't. You were in there for, like, 45 seconds.
Dave smiled sheepishly. "That's how long it took."
"Come on."
Dave sighed. "Kind of like junior high, I guess." Mick shook his head at that, having heard that unsettling story many a time as well. "I'm going again," Dave proclaimed, and headed back to the long line of horny guys. Mick recognized a couple of them also as repeat offenders. He moved in that direction, then looked back at the woman he'd given $5 to. She was watching him with an odd, almost hopeful expression. Again, he was reminded of his kindergarten teacher, observing him try to get the hang of tying his shoes.
"Whoops, sorry," he said.
"Just step in the booth, then you can chase after your friend."
Mick didn't correct her. He just went into the booth and pulled the curtain closed behind him. There was a little screen, either a computer or a television monitor there, tilted up toward him, and some text appeared on it. "Take a deep breath. Stare at the following image. Concentrate." He did so, and on the screen saw a photograph of him standing in front of the booth, staring bemusedly at something off camera. It had been taken when Dave had called out to him. He looked at the picture, feeling a bit self-conscious at how fat he was getting around the middle and how threadbare his shirt was. Sherry had been right to want him to wear something else. And yes, he did need to change his life. Somehow. If it was even possible.
with the laundry list of wrong turns he had made in his day. Maybe. Maybe he could change the road he was on. He was fairly young, and still fairly healthy. Not all doors were closed to him, were they? He remembered to concentrate just as the photograph faded, and the text, "Thank you for donating to East Ridge Elementary," appeared in its place. He opened the curtain and stepped out. The kindergarten teacher gave him an expectant look.
"How do you feel?"
she asked. "Pretty good," he said. And it was the truth. He didn't believe in magic or anything, but the truth was, he could change his life if he really, really wanted to. He could start exercising again. He could talk to his friend who worked mall security to see if they still needed weekend help. And he could try to get back to sculpting, since he'd bought all that clay over a year before and never done anything with it. She nodded at him, then started reading her book again, apparently needing nothing more from him. All right. He'd go spend the rest of the night with his nephew, niece, brother, and sister-in-law. And he'd make the best of it. Things would improve.
So?
Anna asked him, waving him over. Hey, he said, surprised to see his ex-girlfriend at the carnival. She had let her hair grow long and was wearing glasses instead of contacts. She looked so lovely. It was mind-blowing. He had forgotten she had been waiting between the two booths, holding the poorly made giraffe he'd won for her at the dart throw.
Did it work?
She asked him. The booth thing? He stepped nearer to her, looking at her closely. She had mayo from the chicken sandwiches at the corner of her mouth. It kind of did, Mick said, wiping it off her face. She laughed, obviously not believing him. But that was all right.
You sure you don't want to join Dave on the supermodel go-round?
She asked, smiling conspiratorially in that way she had. Dave was about 30 people back there. He gave them the A-OK sign. Mick wasn't sure the last time he'd seen somebody do that. Only sort of, Mick said. He finally shook his head at his brother and chuckled to himself, putting an arm around his wife. He was filled with an almost overwhelming feeling of love for her, a sense of relief, of rightness all around him, though he really couldn't say why.
Let's call it a night, she suggested. We both have work fairly early tomorrow.
She was right. They did, and they'd had enough fun at the carnival they could duck out now, and the kids wouldn't feel cheated. Sounds like a plan, he said. But let's go snag one of Brian's cupcakes first. And they walked off together. The end.
You can dance if you want to.
Okay, and there you have it. Mick went to an elementary school carnival. It's almost a Pavlovian thing now. But you know what I'm going to say? I got to say it every episode. It's not a great story. But, you know, I'm glad that I wrote it. The same as, you know, as I said a moment ago, as I said before I read the story, it shouldn't have gotten written. I wrote it that night on, what was it on? Oh, it was my brother's laptop. My brother got a new laptop sometime in the summer. And he said, "Do you want my old laptop?" And of course I did, because my crap top had broken. My nephew stepped on the screen and it cracked. And to have an actual laptop seemed pretty neat. And I hardly ever use it. Sometimes I'll take it to my friend's house. I pretty much only ever use it to go on trips, because it's a portable thing. But it has been good for writing, because it had, I think it had MS Word on it, or no, it had something else. It was like Windows Office on it, but it had the free sample version. And then last time I went on a vacation and I took it, it let me know that my free samples had been exceeded and I could no longer use that program. And so that's sad and frustrating, but I don't go on many vacations, and so, you know, it hasn't really come up since then. This story came from going to my nephew's elementary school carnival. Duh, right? He just started kindergarten, and we went. Let's say that it was a Thursday night. Maybe it was a Tuesday night. And it was pretty boring, but it was a lot of really happy families together and me. And the next day, I jotted down an idea of, you know, what if you went, and there turned out to be these booths, like really scary booths or whatever, that worked all too well. That was pretty much just the premise. And then if I hadn't gone camping that weekend, and maybe it was the next week, it never would have gone anywhere, because it's a flimsy premise. It was meant to be a scary story, I think, and it ended up not being. But I forced myself to write it, and I really ought to do that more often, because a lot of times all it takes is a kick in the pants, whether it's from someone else or from myself, to say, okay, go, 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 do it. Write it through to the end. You can do this. I've got some stories out there that I think are really good, and I've got some stories out there that I think are pretty mediocre. I forced myself to write it through to the end, and then I went to sleep, and it was nice. I like going to the cabin because there's so few distractions. I force myself to work a lot of times while I'm there, and that's neat. My mom had a little beach house down in Oceanside, California for a very short time. It was right before the economy sort of crashed, and turned out the value of that beach house just plummeted, and she lost so much money on it. But when I lived in Los Angeles, I drove down there to the beach house once, and the whole purpose for going was to write. And I cannot remember how much I got done, if I got any writing done or not. But that was my goal. That was why I went down there. And it's neat to have a place where you can say, I'm going to go and I'm going to write. It's like Colin Firth in Love Actually going to that retreat in Italy or wherever it was. It's like Jack Torrance going to the Overlook Hotel. I like the idea of going to a place and that is where you're going to write. Brian Lincoln and some of the other podcasters I know had a writer's retreat just recently. And they all went to a cabin someplace together, and they hung out, and they played games, and they got drunk, and they ate food. But most of the time, it was writing they were there to do. And so there would be, you know, set times. For the next 4 hours, you can't talk to anybody. Just sit and write. And holy cow, that would be so wonderful. I don't know if I would accomplish a lot, but I know that it would be exactly what I need. Where there's no distractions, where you're there to write, where the focus is do this. I don't know if magic would happen, but work would definitely get done. Anyway, that was point one. Point two I wanted to make was all the characters in this story are named after people I worked with at Laser Blazer, which was a video store in Los Angeles. The only people that worked there were people who really, really loved movies. And they were all cool people. And Mick was a good, good guy who was a little bit older than me, and I would ask him questions about the 70s. And anyhow, Mick is a funny name. It's a racial slur, but it's also, it seems like a nickname rather than a real name. But I've known people whose names were actually Mick, and wasn't a racial slur for them. The third thing I wanted to say is, a couple of days ago I sent this story to Clay Duggar, who is a podcaster and a writer, who I know somewhat, but he had bugged me months ago about, hey, send me a story, I'll be a beta reader, because you complained once that you don't have anybody to be a beta reader, and I don't know if that's what I complained about. I complain that I don't have a first reader, an intended reader, a constant reader, a long-time companion. I don't have someone to sleep with is basically what I was complaining about. No, you know how people who are writers have a wife or a manager or a best friend or an agent who reads their stuff first and gives them all sorts of notes on it, and they're the person that they think about while they're writing. You know, that's who's going to read this first. And so here's a joke or here's a line that he'll be sure to appreciate. I tend to not have that. A lot of the times I don't share my writing with anybody, and so, you know, hey, I'm my first reader and last. So I mentioned that somewhere, and Clay said, hey, I'll be your beta reader. And I never sent him anything because the things that I write tend to be in notebooks. And then I will type one up, one out of, let's say, five stories that I finish, I type up. And in typing it, that's the second draft. Sometimes that's all I ever get is a second draft. Sometimes I'll do like a polish before I put it out to Smashwords or send it to some podcast or magazine that's not going to run it. But I got this out, and I looked it over because it said Mick Goes To, and I think that was all the title that showed up on my file. And I was just like, Mick Goes To The Bathroom? I've never written something called that. What the hell? And I opened it and I was just like, oh, Elementary School Carnival. Okay. Yeah, I did write that. And I thought, I'm going to do this as a podcast. Maybe I'll put it out on Smashwords. I try to put stuff on Smashwords all the time. For like a month of September or October, whenever I first started doing Smashwords, I had a goal to put a story up a week. And then November and December, I got super busy and I wasn't able to do it anymore. But in January, once I wasn't busy again, I said, okay, that's my goal, a story a week. And I haven't put anything up this week, so maybe this story will go up there. But I sent it to Clay, and then I started the recording. And before I finished the recording, he had emailed me back. I guess he'd listened to it at lunch or something like that. And he gave me a couple of notes on it. And he said two things that stuck with me. One was that it was too long. The story is about 3,000 words, and he figured it could be about 1,500 words and lose nothing. If I say that I disagree with him, then I'm an a-hole, and I'm not grateful for his help. But there's no such thing as a good story that's 1,500 words. I'm sorry, there just isn't. Stephen King could write a story that's 1,500 words, and I'd be like, wow, that's almost good, Steve. When you flesh that out to an actual short story, boy, that's going to be great. Essentially, I guess he's saying the story was twice as long as it needed to be. And, you know, that may be true. There may be, I think he said that there was fluff in there, and that's probably very true. But this was a story I wrote, not really knowing where it was going to go, and what ended up happening happened. And in a second draft, maybe I could cut it a little bit. But more likely what would happen if I went through it looking for things to cut is I would find things that I wanted to expand on. His relationship with his brother. What he thinks about the kids. It would end up going from 3,000 words to 4,500 words. And I don't know if it would be a better story, but that's how I write. For me, the way to make a story better is to add to it, to give it more details, to give it more dialogue. And you know what? Maybe that's a failing of mine, but that's how I write. It's too late to turn back now, as the song goes. The other point that he made was that the ending was confusing. And as I hadn't recorded the ending yet, I thought, well, okay, that's something that I can actually address in the audio version. It is confusing, because basically what I wanted to do was just have the wife walk up to him and he doesn't comment on it, that now I have a wife and I didn't before. He just accepts it because reality has changed. And the audience is the one that's supposed to say, oh, He did change his life. Okay, I see. I see what you did there. And that's hopefully where it stands now. Because he should go, what the hell are you doing here, Anna? I thought you were my ex-girlfriend and we had an argument and all that stuff. And she's like, don't be silly, I'm your wife. And we're perfectly happy. And I've been growing my hair out because I love you. That's sort of an as you know, Bob. But I'm not doing that. I just wanted it to be, as soon as he saw his wife, he just, oh, okay, yeah, that's right. Whoops, why didn't I remember that I'm married? Because reality has changed. And it just takes 30 seconds or so before it kicks in. Maybe that is confusing. Maybe that is not as powerful as it could be, or as well done as it could be. I've dealt with this phenomenon before of reality changing or of time travel changing things. Part of it is because it happened in Back to the Future, and I love it so much in Back to the Future. The absolute best ending to a movie ever is the ending of Back to the Future. And there is a little bit of comment on it. Mom, you're so thin. Well, thank you, Marty. And I love the ending of Back to the Future so much. I could cry telling you how much I love it. That, you know, he makes it back home, which is his goal. But home is better than the way he left it. This kid fixed his life. His parents' life. His brother and his sister's lives. Inadvertently. Oh my gosh, I love that. And there was that 1987 movie, Masters of the Universe. And it basically had the same ending. And I don't care. I loved that ending. I was just like, holy cow, they did it again. Stephen King wrote a story called Word Processor of the Gods, which is such a good story. Why have I not recorded that? Oh, remind me to record that and send a copy to Marshall Latham. He'll dig it. And in Word Processor of the Gods, it ends exactly the same way. And I guess that's what I wanted to do. But I don't know that I earned it in this story. Because this story, like I said, isn't great. It's just kind of a lark. It's kind of a throwaway story that I wrote. And then I'll give it away for free on Smashwords. And I'm giving it away for free here, obviously. I've written about somebody changing their lives before. Okay, let me rephrase. I've ripped off the ending of Back to the Future before. And I've probably done it better. And I did a story a couple years ago that doesn't have a title because I never finished it. I wrote the beginning, the middle, skipped a scene, and then wrote the end. And I never wrote that scene, which makes me an idiot. I need to go on a writer's retreat so that I can do that. And that was all about this. It was all about the timeline being changed. And then him having to change it back. Him having to go back. And that one I put a lot more heart into, I think. And so if I ever finished that one, maybe I would try extra hard to make that one better. This one's done. This one's just a short little story. Not great, like I say. You know, maybe that's what we'll do when it comes time to summing up this podcast on iTunes or whatever. I'll say, you know, Rish will present stories of his that aren't great, but he's presenting them anyway, along with a little bit of commentary on the end. And we've reached the end because I have made it to Big's house, and I've said a lot of nothing. Enough, I think, I've said. I really like doing this podcast, and if you like hearing me do the podcast, thank you. Let me know, because I'll do more of it. You have a great night. Change your life. It's only $5. Goodbye.
The Rish Outcast has been released under a Creative Commons Attribution No Derivatives 3.0 license. That allows you to listen to it, copy it, and share it, but not to sell it, edit it, distort it, or otherwise have your way with it. I know how you are. The music in today's episode was presented by Kevin MacLeod of the website incompetech.com.
By the way, if there is an obnoxious buzzing going on this, I apologize. I have had some problems with this recorder, but it's very unpredictable. The problems will go away for weeks and then suddenly be back. But I've decided today that I've got to get a new recorder. And so this will be the last episode of the Rish Outcast recorded on this machine. So if there is a buzzing, I apologize. Please just ignore it and know that this is the last one that will have that buzzing.